Hello and welcome to Word Salad Radio presents Quote Unquote Guilty.
I was not ready for this.
I'm your host, Joe Ketchum, and I'm joined today by Cadaver Dad Jeff Burnham.
Hello.
How's it going, Jeff?
Second beer of the evening. Getting into the thick of it.
What are you drinking over there in Frankenstein's Monkey Farm?
I am drinking Around the Bend Beer Company's Vera Pistachio Cream Ale.
Oh, that stuff is yummy.
Dude, it's my favorite beer. I will drink anything Around the Bend puts out just so I can support them so they keep releasing Vera.
I'm thinking of the right one. That's the one you had me try?
Probably. It's the one with like the plague doctor on it, basically.
It tastes like graham cracker and happiness.
Oh, no. That's a good one. The Grammy cakes from, I don't remember what company that was, but I have not been able to find more of that. And I have been back to that same store like 7 times looking. Oh,
I'm drinking a blackberry cider, hard cider, from Two Towns Cider House, which is one of the things I brought with me from Chicago. I brought a 6-pack of assorted ciders that we had in our pantry.
And I figured if you were drinking on the podcast by yourself, that's a sign of depression. So, I had to join you.
It's the big 3-5 tomorrow. I don't know if I can take it.
I know.
just getting old and falling apart over here.
Well, soon,
I'm excited,
though.
I'm going to go see Ready or Not with some guys from work.
Oh, nice. Nice.
That movie, I hear good things. It looks real good. I'm excited.
Yeah, it looks fantastic.
Yeah. So, that's my plan. Get some Chinese food and go see Ready or Not.
My plan on my birthday is to try to not work on my classes.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I'm going to be sitting at home going, you should work on your classes. They start next week. And then I got to fight that urge.
Yeah, you got to repress it. You got to shout that down.
I'll just be like, it's 9 a.m. Time to drink.
Bring on the alcohols.
If you get drunk, you can't work on classes. That's not true. I don't get drunk at 9 a.m. I work at a Catholic university and they wouldn't like to hear it.
Oh, man, no one drinks like the Catholics, so I don't feel like you have to defend that.
Yeah, but my... Oh, fuck. I was about to deliver a religious joke, but we'll skip it.
Yeah, probably safe. I'm getting some fun, very flattering reviews on iTunes, so maybe I don't want to scare people away with your anti-religious bigotry.
There's nobody out there is as anti-religious as those who work at religious universities, you know?
Amen. Allah be praised. So it's Friday the 13th.
For you, listeners.
When this comes out, yeah. So as has been the tradition here at Word Salad Radio on Quote Unquote Guilty, we do an episode about a Jason Voorhees movie every Friday the 13th.
Voorhees.
And the last one was like last summer.
It was that
like,
when we did the remake?
Yeah, when we did the reboot. It was like July 13th.
Oh, reboot. You're right. It was a reboot. You're right.
Yeah. And I
reimagining.
I remember during that recording, looking ahead to the next Friday the 13th, I was like, it's not for another year and a half. So here we are, a year and a half later. Well, not quite a year and a half, but a year and a quarter later for the next Friday the 13th.
Take a few more drinks and the math will make sense.
That's right. Drink it up. Drink down the math. So we are doing Friday the 13th, part 4, the final chapter. It doesn't even say part 4, does it? It's just Friday the 13th, final chapter.
But I always call it that. I always call it Friday the 13th, part 4, the final chapter. I always call it the whole thing.
There's a few the final Friday the 13th, or there's at least two, I guess, because Jason Goes to Hell is the final Friday. That might be the only other final one in the series that isn't actually the final one in the series.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember what the other subtitles were. I mean, there's like whatever, New Blood.
New Beginning.
New Beginning, is that what it was?
That's the fifth one. And then New Blood, I think, is the seventh one.
Seventh? Yeah.
And then Jason Lives.
Jason versus Carrie.
Jason versus Carrie, that's seven, yeah. One we will never do on the podcast.
Well, I mean, we're basically doing it tonight.
I would have to find someone who would watch it, and I would have to rewatch it.
I mean, I would watch it, but like the whole podcast would be just me explaining, well, this part is exactly like that other part in number four.
So seven's like a shitty four.
Plus Carrie.
Plus you have Carrie.
And Terry Kaiser. So
yeah,
you got those two things.
But that movie's a bag of dog shit. But
I mean,
the final chapter is a great Friday the 13th movie.
Yes, it is, to my mind, the greatest. Though, you know, I totally buy everybody's case for six. Anybody who claims six is the greatest, I think it's pretty close.
Yeah, four isn't my favorite, but rewatching it, I was like, this is the best one. Like, objectively, the final chapter is the best one. It's so good. It's so quotable. It's got, like, the best kills. It's great.
Which one's your favorite? X?
X is my favorite, yeah. I have the most fun with Jason X.
Appropriately. But no, I mean, the final chapter is the best film.
Yes.
For reasons that we will talk about. Many, many reasons. It is the best film. I think, yeah, X is extremely fun. Six is really fun, too. And Six has a lot of really great ideas and is really funny. But Four is the best film. It's like, if you have to make a Jason movie, this is the best you could do.
Absolutely. It's, you really care about the characters. It's super quotable. It's super bloody. There's gratuitous nudity. I mean, it's everything you want in a Jason movie, and it's really well put together.
Yeah. I mean, I rewatching it here the other night, I don't know that I found a single thing that I was like, well, that's a bit weak.
Yeah, no. I was like, they don't even like phone in any of the deaths. Like, it feels like every death, they're like, we got to do something really cool for this death.
Yeah, it feels like moving forward after this is where the censors really raked them over the coals. And I know they were already getting a bunch of flack at this point, but I know going into five, they were butchering, you know, the kills left and right. You know, like they were cutting out half of all the gore. And it doesn't quite feel like that here.
No, it's cranked up to 11. There's a lot of great, like, stabbings and heads being twisted around and people getting thrown out of windows.
I forgot about the head twisting.
Oh, man, that was so good.
Ugh, that really, I was like, I mean, I've seen the movie more than any other, you know, Friday the 13th movie. And I was still like, oh, God, that's a little excessive, isn't it?
That's like, our first death, totally took me too. By surprise. That's our first kill is the medical examiner. And he gets his throat slit and then his head gets ripped around backwards because the throat slitting wasn't enough.
Yeah, and I remembered the throat slitting and I was like, oh, this is a cool one. And I was like, oh, God, Axel, you poor bastard. And that's, of course, it's the first kill apart from the opening, which recaps the first three movies.
Yeah, I didn't count any of those.
No. But it's still an impressive, like, gore fest, that first 3 minutes.
Yeah, it's a nice previously on Jason montage.
But it's like so good that I feel like if you started with the final chapter, if this was the first one you saw, it would set an expectation for the rest of the movies that going back and rewatching them, they couldn't possibly live up to because you'd see the clips out of context, then you watch the final chapter, and then you go back to 1 through 3, and they're just not as good.
Yeah, and that's fair. Like when I watched the big, long documentary about Friday the 13th a couple of Halloweens ago, and then I got it in me to, like, rewatch the series, and I watched the first one. I was like, man, I'll get around to the others.
Well, it was like that year where there were the three Friday the 13ths, you know? I was like, oh, I'm going to watch the whole series this year. And I got through 8 of them, I think is all I made it through. Maybe through Jason Goes to Hell. Maybe that's as far as I got, but it was tough. Just getting through those in a year for me was a chore.
Yeah. I mean, in the middle there's some real, real tough going movie watching wise.
Yeah. 5, 7, and 8 are pretty tough for me.
Absolutely. 5 is just so boring from what I remember.
5 is not a bad movie, except for the fact that it's just too much of that movie.
Yeah.
I feel like you could trim easily 10 minutes out of that thing and not lose anything.
I'm sure I'll rewatch it at some point because I don't remember it really. Just, I remember the big twist that it's not really Jason. It's just like an imposter.
Twist your neck.
That's the first kill in this movie. Big twist.
My neck twister.
Where do we want to dive into this bad boy?
You know, there's surprisingly some really well, really funny stuff, but also some really good stuff before the movie even really gets underway. Like, before Axel's death, even. Like, there's some really good stuff. One preposterous thing is when the cops are bagging up the evidence, like, at the crime scene from number 3.
Uh-huh.
Because it, like, picks up exactly where 3 left off. You know, Jason had an axe to the face. Everybody's dead from the third movie. But there's, like, 2 cops bagging up the evidence of the axe. Totally bare hands.
Like, this probably isn't important.
Yeah, and it's like the one's really delicately trying to get the evidence bag around the, you know, the head of the axe, while the other cop is completely barehanded holding the handle. That's just a weird thing.
There's a whole separate plot where the one guy is trying to frame the other guy for a murder.
Yeah, he's got this really dopey sidekick.
Yeah.
And he's like, I can't, this guy follows me around everywhere. And, you know, I gotta get rid of him.
There's got to be easier ways to get rid of him than frame him for murder, but...
I mean, yeah, you know, plant drugs on him, something.
Yeah, sure. Got those lying around.
Why not? Okay, so, right, they're cleaning up the crime scene and everything, and they're taking all the bodies away, and they're loading Jason's body up and everything. And then the cop cars and the ambulances and the helicopters or whatever, like, they all leave the scene, you know, the location from number 3. They all leave. And there's, I don't know, it's maybe like 15 seconds, maybe a little bit longer, maybe even less. But there's just this stretch of film where we focus on this dark, completely motionless, like it was like a farm or whatever. There was like a barn where the climax of the third one took place.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're focusing on this location where all of these horrible, horrible murders took place, except it's totally peaceful and dark. Middle of the night, quiet. And I don't think I ever really thought about it before, but rewatching it for this, I found that to be incredibly haunting. Like, just, you know, a location like that, any farmhouse, any place out in the country, quiet at night, could just as easily be the site of a horrible, like, series of murders.
Yeah, I get that.
You know, like every time you walk into some place out in the woods that's quiet and dark and you think, wow, it's peaceful here. It could also be home to a Jason, yeah. You know?
It was weird to me before that, before the ambulances leave, like when the ambulance first shows up at the crime scene, it was like, okay, where's the, we're here to help. And it was like, yeah, everyone's dead.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone's dead. You can pull up over there. And the guy goes, everyone's dead. Some emergency.
They get a lot of these out there, you know? I mean, like, the Crystal Lake area, you know, it's just replete with mass murders.
Why did I rush out here if everyone's dead? I'll just take my time. We need to have a chat about what constitutes an emergency.
I mean, halfway across town, there's another mass murder taking place where, honestly, our efforts would be better appreciated.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we could get there in time to actually save people. That's how emergencies work. this is a tight movie too. I started it late a couple nights ago and I turned it off with like 20 minutes to go. I was like, man, there's not much left. It's just, I was amazed at how much had happened, but how quickly and how quickly it was going to wrap up. It's just a tight movie.
Yeah. I mean, the characterization is really simple for all of the characters because there's a ton of characters.
Yeah.
There has to be because Jason kills 13 people in the movie. So
I counted 12.
Well, that's if we include Mom, who's not
killed on screen. Oh, because we don't see her die. Yeah, you're right.
She may be one of the things that's lost thanks to censorship. I don't know. I didn't look on the special features because I was watching it really late and I didn't go through to see if there were cut kills or anything. But if we count Mom, it's 13. But if we count Jason and not Mom, we also get 13 deaths. So one way or the other.
I didn't count Jason either because, you know, he's never really dead.
Well, except he is dead.
He does die in this one because he comes back as a zombie in the 6th one.
Yeah, because Tommy Jarvis from this one is like, oh, I'm not content with Jason being dead, so I'm going to go stab his corpse with a lightning rod, essentially.
He wrought his own destruction in that one. You can go listen to Quote Unquote Guilty, all about Jason Lives, where we talk about how dumb Tommy Jarvis is. Just can't let things be.
One thing I do like from that one, I'm sure you covered it, or did we cover it? Who talked about that with you?
That was me and Ray. Ray is a big fan of part six.
I was like, I felt like I listened to that one, but I don't think I was on it. So, but yeah, the whole idea of them renaming Crystal Lake is really funny.
Oh, yeah.
They're like, we don't want to be associated with those murders. So now we're, what was it called?
Oh,
something green.
Oh, yeah. It was like Green Prairie or something like that.
It's lost on me at the moment.
Yeah, I don't know. But it is funny that they like rebrand.
Yeah, no, I mean, you would. You'd have to. But speaking of branding, I like the branding of our, coroner mortician guy, Axel, as the Super Bowl of self-abuse. That's a good line.
Because he's, like, getting off to an exercise video, and then he keeps, like, turning it on as he's making out with the nurse, because I guess that's the only way he can get hard.
I don't know. And, like, also how... I mean, maybe I don't know how ladies work or something. The idea that he, like, has this woman come meet him, whatever, in the morgue. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a place where you want to have sex in the first place, right? And then pretend to be a dead body to scare the shit out of her. How is that going to work? Like, the scaring the hell out of her, pretending to be a dead body, and then still getting the sex? I don't know how that math works out. I don't know how that adds up, but...
I don't know. I think there's some connection between fear and arousal, and, you know, you get the shot of adrenaline. It doesn't really do anything for me, but I can understand if other people are into that.
So that's just that nurse's thing?
I think, yeah, I think he knows that nurse is into that kind of thing.
God damn that we talked about that already, because I just realized we have to talk about guilty pleasures at the end of this fucking podcast, don't we? Son of a bitch.
Yep, that's how it works.
Shit. Bring back Word Salad Radio. When Axel puts Jason in the drawer, there's a really nice shot, one of these little subtle things. And the movie's got a lot of subtle stuff going on in it that I don't know that I always appreciate, especially because I'm usually watching it with a group, you know. If somebody's like, oh, let's watch Friday the 13th. And I'm like, well, there's only one to watch, so this is the one. But when he pushes Jason into the drawer, you know, because it's cold, it's, you know, got a coolant system inside there so you don't have to smell the dead bodies rotting. You see Jason's breath just a little bit as he closes the door.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so nice. I mean, what a great little hint.
Because, I mean, the inevitability that he's alive and going to come back is there. It's just, so you need just a little wisp and it's, yeah.
It's a great shot.
Creepy.
And then Axel gets his neck twisted.
It's his head all reversed.
But he's like watching that aerobics tape, and there's that absolutely ludicrous shot in the aerobics tape that I always elicits a laugh when you watch it with people for the first time, where the three women who are doing aerobics are like bent over and they're like pointing their butts at each other's butts.
Yeah.
And they're like, and they're just like lifting and then like lowering their asses at each other. I don't know. That is a crazy shot.
It makes you wonder why that exists if not for masturbation purposes.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's where the logic of it is, you know, comes into question. Like, who is this for, this video, if not guys to be watching who are perverts?
Yeah.
Because, like, I mean, if a woman watches this, she's going to be like, what's with the, like, asses pointing at asses shot thing? Like, just show me the exercise so I can get in shape. You know, unless, of course, the woman's into that thing, too. So I guess perverted woman may also get something out of that. But if you're buying this tape just to, like, exercise, you might feel a bit exploited when doing that particular motion.
All right, ladies, now team up with two of your friends and bounce your asses at each other. Why?
The next exercise is fondle your own breasts and make kissy faces at the mirror.
Kissy faces burns 10 calories a minute.
And smooch.
It's that new fad exercise everyone's raving about. Kissy.
It's the hips and lips tape.
After the first three deaths, which, who was the third one? Oh, the hitchhiking hippie chick.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, this movie has a lot of breasts to get to. It's already three deep on deaths and no breasts.
Instantaneously. Three pairs of breasts.
Then, yeah, and then we have a skinny dipping scene. I was like, oh, well, that was easy.
Yeah, I was also alarmed at how quickly they made up ground. I was like, oh, shit. We actually hit an even ratio here. It's neck and neck. Which, okay, I know we've talked about it before on the show. But in case this is somebody's first episode, we should talk about...
It's very important.
the breast to death ratio concept.
Yes.
Did you want to lead the conversation and we can
very quickly, you know, it's pretty much exactly what it sounds like. The ideal horror movie will have as many deaths and pairs of breasts in it.
Or at least like from an industry perspective, right? I mean, not to say like that's something that I look for in a movie because I don't care how many breasts or deaths are in the movie so long as it's a good movie.
Yeah.
But like when we were teenagers watching these things, you know, we suddenly became aware that, wow, a lot of deaths, a lot of breasts, you know, but it was obvious when a movie would have a lot of deaths and then no breasts, like you would notice that, you know, because the movies always had this kind of quota that they had to meet. The same way that you'd also notice if you're watching a horror movie and basically nobody dies, you'd also notice that.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? It's like maybe a lot of gore and torture, but not a lot of death. And maybe a ton of breasts. You'd probably notice that you'd just be being like, out of whack.
You'd just be like, this is practically a porn and not a horror film.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And that's something that, like, in the 1980s was actually a thing, you know? That, like, I can't remember the name of the movie. God, I wish I could. Maybe like, Final Terror or something like that. I've never seen the actual movie, but I've seen an interview with the filmmaker. And the final cut of the film has, like, 5 deaths or something in it. But the original cut had like 3. And so when they finished the film, they went to get it distributed. And this was, again, in the early 80s, right? And they went to get it distributed. And the distributor was like, this has 3 deaths in it. That's not going to cut it. The average for these movies now is 5. So they added in a random scene where like hitchhikers or somebody get killed, right? Or some hikers in the mountains get killed. And they brought it back. And by the time they got it back, the distributors were like, the average right now is 7. And so they eventually had to just sort of cut their losses and release it as is because they couldn't keep going and filming more because the numbers were ratcheting up.
Yeah.
And that's thanks in no small part to the Friday the 13th series, which by its 4th installment was up to 13 Jason kills. You know, like that's a shitload of murder in one movie. And that's not counting the opening, like, recap of 1 through 3, which shows most of those kills, too.
It's a bloody recap. And why we bring it up with the breast-to-death ratio with this movie is that it's very close, and depending on how you look at it, it is a perfect breast-to-death ratio, which is very rare, actually, in horror movies.
Yeah, I had trouble replicating our original count from, like, whenever that was, 2006 4? Or whenever we did that.
Yeah.
Because I remember us counting this maybe at Mike Fountain's when we were staying out there doing marathons of horror movies.
Maybe.
Or Mike's. I don't know. Maybe bleep out his last name. I don't know. Maybe he doesn't want to be associated with this nonsense. But like similarly, the idea of having a certain number of breasts in a movie is something that was also codified by distributors. You know, like this isn't something that we're also... I basically just want to point out we're not total pervos. You know what I mean?
Just a fan of the conventions of the genre.
Exactly. But Roger Corman had a philosophy, which I think Joe Bob Briggs talked about. I don't remember where I heard this particular Corman philosophy, but the idea was, and I may have heard it from Corman in an interview, but Corman had this idea that you would include 4 scenes with breasts. You'd have 2 scenes with breasts really early on, one of them being with one of the leads of the movie. You'd have somewhere in the middle a scene with breasts, and then somewhere near the end a scene with breasts. And if you did that, audiences would leave the movie having perceived that they had seen more breasts than they actually had. But of course, when you get into the 80s, this era of excess, you know, the Reagan greed is good era, you don't want to just have the sensation of more breasts. Like, you gotta have all the breasts.
Have a reality of more breasts. And the weird thing about this movie is that in order to meet its breast quota, we have our characters find, like, a silent nudie movie and watch it through a lot of the climax. Yeah, they're essentially watching Orgy of the Dead, but an old silent movie version. It's just a bunch of naked women dancing around.
Yeah, and there's like clearly some of them are just like on a stage like a stag reel. But it seems almost like it's 3 or 4 stag reels that he's watching, you know, like these old things where it would just be a 5-minute silent thing where a woman just takes a bath. Which I actually, back in my film school days, I ended up with a few of those just for like on 16 millimeter because I was going to do some like, I don't know, film art piece thing, and I had like all this like these bug documentaries, and I was putting like bugs and nudity together, and I never did that. But, you know, I had a bunch of those things, which are weird. It was like a woman just like shaving her armpits topless, and it was like weird, you know. I mean, that's what he's basically watching in this movie to meet that quota. And also, in order to meet the quota, you also have to count the breasts in the Joe Bob Briggs standard way, which is you can have repeated pairs of breasts so long as it's a different scene. So like the same actor, you know, she could take her top off in three different scenes, and that counts as three.
Right.
You know, three scenes with breasts.
I think the only repeat, though, is the one girl at the lake who then goes skinny dipping by herself at night.
Sam, yeah.
Yeah, I think...
I also, though, counted her scene later on near the end of the skinny dipping where she's trying to convince Sarah. Because I was also tallying it, trying to repeat our count. When she goes to try to convince Sarah to go skinny dipping, that feels later enough to me, and it's in a different location, that I was like, I think technically that counts.
Okay. I felt like that was the first time we saw her breasts. But a lot of the people in this just look very similar. It's like Crispin Glover and a bunch of white people.
Well, fair enough.
So when one girl takes off her clothes, like, have I already seen her breasts? I don't know. I'm counting it.
Well, you have the twins, you know, who automatically look identical.
Yeah, but and, I feel like you only see one of the twins' breasts, like when they dive in the water or... Yeah, like they strip off and they go into the water, and you really only see one of them. And even during the one sex scene later, you don't really see her. So it's interesting.
I was trying really hard to make this count work because I was like, if we're going to record this episode, I want to make sure that our count was accurate. So I paid close attention. You did see, I mean, you have to, one of them you don't see fully clearly. I know I sound like a freaking pervert. This sucks.
We should just move
on. I fucking hate it. No, no.
It's we're very keep analytical going nudity watching.
Like, but it was the twins in that scene and Sam. Sam comes back to the like dock thing to try to convince Sarah. Sam later has her top off when she goes skinny dipping again randomly at night. And then we get a bunch of the stag reels. But I still only came up with 12. Like, even being generous with the lake scene, I still only came up with 12 unless we count Sarah...
In the shower.
Who in the shower, which is not clear. It's not totally clear. I think we fudged it a little bit back in the day because we loved Jason movies that much.
Yeah.
I think we fudged it just for our own, I don't know, pride?
Yeah, I got 12 counting Sarah, but there's like an asterisk next to her.
Yeah, and I think if you do count Sam's second... as a separate, then that's 13. That's what I got.
So it's an imperfect science.
No, and it doesn't matter, like I said, but it is from an industrial perspective, though, it is fascinating to see that they were like, we're going to go out with this fourth movie. This is going to be the final chapter. We're not going to make any more of these. Let's get 13 Jason kills and let's get 13 pairs of breasts on the screen. And if they were stymied at any point, it was probably because of that one actress's, no nipple clause, you know, in her contract. And so they just didn't quite meet it, or they had to cut one scene, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just from an industrial perspective, that's interesting. I also can't imagine, as a filmmaker myself, asking anybody to get naked.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's crazy to me.
That's a weird conversation to have.
I would be more apt to have penis in my film than breasts.
Oh, sure. Need more dong movies.
Where's the dick, man?
King Dong. The Age of King Dong.
That's and I may have told this on the show before, but I tell my film students this all the time, because when I was taking production as an undergrad, if somebody was making a short film and they'd made a short film where it's like a guy gets undressed, you know, and it kind of like teases, and it like maybe it'll show like, you know, the upper pelvic region, you know, or whatever, where it shows them from the side but kind of like hidden, he'd go, where's the dick, man? Where's the dick? And he'd be like, don't half-ass it. If you're gonna promise the dick, you show the dick. And he was like, there's nothing wrong with it, it's the human body, you show the dick. Where's the dick, man? And then somebody had their final film was about this couple who fall in love while they're nude modeling. And so it was like the woman was nude and then the man is nude And he's like, oh, where's the dick? You know, like during the first scene. And the second scene shows them both like full frontal nudity. And he goes, there's the dick, man, there it is. He was so happy. So I think about it. And I was actually watching, I guess, spoilers for Ma, I suppose.
There's a dick in it.
You see a dick in Ma. And I was like, there's the dick, man. Like every time I see a penis in movie, that's what I shout. There's a dick, man. There it is.
Oh, that's gold. I think since I got Mubi, I see a lot more dicks. It's a lot of foreign, that's true. a lot of foreign films on Mubi, a lot of dicks.
I remember watching, so you know, when I was working out in the parking lot, I would watch movies while I was working in the parking lot. And I remember one time I ended up watching Rainer Werner Fassbender's Fox and His Friends, which has easily the most penis I've ever seen in any movie. Like every scene had like 12 penises in it. It was bananas. Actually bananas.
Nice pun.
I didn't think about it until I said it. I'm very happy with it. I stand by it. And I remember I was like watching this and I didn't turn it off. I just sat through the whole thing out in the parking lot. But every time there'd be like a screen full of penises, I would like lean the screen way back so that nobody could possibly see it walking by on the sidewalk. But that's foreign film for you. Because they don't got the hang-ups we do.
They do not. They're not hung up or nothing.
Not we, but like other
Americans.
Americanos.
Yeah. The American film industry hates their dicks.
Me, I want to know. Where's the dick, man?
Where's the dick, man? I wrote down like random lines and I'm having trouble placing them in context. But one that must be pretty early on that I loved was Jesus Christmas. Holy Jesus, goddamn. Holy jumping Jesus shit.
Yeah, that's Axel.
What's he responding to? Is that when Jason's arm falls on them?
Yeah, it's when his arm falls out when they're making out. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to write that down and I was like, I'm not going to write this down because I'm keeping track of other things. I hope Joe writes it down.
Holy jumping Jesus shit is my favorite curse ever.
It's a good one.
I'm not 100% sure I got it correct, exactly right, but I kind of wrote it down right after he said it from memory.
It's pretty close, if not accurate.
It's got to be pretty close. I doubt it was better than this. Maybe I improved on it. Holy jumping Jesus shit.
Some of that English instructor, you know,
bravado.
Revisionism.
Yeah. And then we're introduced to Corey Feldman, who makes horror masks.
Which is really clearly just, you know, it's for the production value of having all these cool masks in the movie. But it's clearly just the, you know, the special effects people's masks.
Yeah.
And they just are like, well, how are we going to make this movie look sort of more expensive and more impressive than it really is? Well, how about we take our entire workshop and just put it in the movie and we'll just bullshit it.
And then Tommy can show it to people. He can demonstrate how the masks work to different people.
Yeah. Like, but it works. I think it's amazing.
It's a cool character trait, and it's weird that it doesn't really come into play in the movie. It's just a weird background idiosyncrasy. It should. Like, at the end where he confronts Jason and he's shaved his head to look like Jason, is like, why not wear a mask that kind of appropriates a Jason face?
Or like if he used some sort of putty or something to make his face a little malformed,
threw something
Jason
on his eye, yeah.
You know, that kind of a thing definitely would push it over that edge. But like when he is shaving his head and pretending to be Jason and he kind of does like a makeup thing, that's almost tying it all together, but not quite. It doesn't quite hold any water.
Yeah. It's a weird moment in the movie where he shows up bald talking to Jason. Like, I appreciate the experimentalism of it, but it's a strange choice.
But he's not just like a mask maker and apparently a makeup artist. He's also like a mechanic. He's like the person they trust to like fix their car, yeah, and like ensure that the electricity is running. And he's like 9 years old. I don't know how old he is, but he's young.
I kind of took it as like a sexist thing where it's like just because he's the man, he's more capable than these two grown ass women at doing things.
You could, sure. I mean, it's
the
Friday the 13th
series. We're not going to learn how to
fix the car.
This 9-year-old boy can do it.
Of course he can't, but then a real man comes along.
With a knife shows up. And he's like, let me electrocute your solenoid.
Yeah. And I'm also unclear as to whether or not what he did had anything to do with this solenoid deal that Tommy's talking about. I don't know anything about cars, so
yeah, I don't know.
I couldn't.
I don't know if that's a genuine auto mechanic repair trick where you bridge an electrical current under the hood somewhere and it does things. Seems unlikely that that would be a method for fixing a car of any problem.
It sounds a bit dangerous from a personal safety perspective.
What does the hitchhiking girl sign say?
Canada and love?
Okay.
I think something like that.
All right.
Like she's trying to get to Canada. She's in New Jersey, of course, or somewhere upstate.
Is that canonically where Crystal Lake is New Jersey?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where all the camp movies are set, in the general New Jersey, you know, upstate New York area.
Right.
But they also have New Jersey license plates, so.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
So there's that. But yeah, she's trying to get to Canada. But of course, we haven't even talked about we've talked a little bit about them, but the whole group of teenagers who are the sort of rolling body count moving into the movie.
Yeah.
It's like a car full of future corpses. Just
slasher fodder.
Yeah. The grave or bust, you know, stenciled on the side of their station wagon.
I will choose the grave. Says an excited Jason Voorhees.
If he could talk.
Yeah, so who do we have? Like, we're introduced to... I'm not going to remember most of their names. We're introduced to Sarah. I know all of
their names.
And who's the other girl who's, like, already at the cabin?
The one who lives... Like, Tommy's sister.
No, you mean. No, the one who is talking to Sarah. Like, the first we see, it's her and Sarah, like, talking about the sleeping arrangements.
Oh, like, in the middle of the car. It's Sarah and Sam, and then their boyfriends. Sarah's starting to see Doug?
Love interest, yeah.
Yeah, and then Sam and Paul are a couple, Samantha and Paul.
Right, yeah, I remember Paulie.
Yep.
There's and the so, twins, yeah, you, Tina and not Tina.
Who we don't meet till later, Tina and Terry.
Okay.
I believe.
I think that's right from the opening credits. That sounds right.
But in the car driving there to go stay at the cabin and drink and party, because that's what you got to do if you're going to get killed in a slasher movie. You have Doug and Paul, Sarah and Sam, and then in the way backseas part of the station wagon, you know, in the no seatbelt area where we all used to sit in the late 80s, early 90s, despite the pleas of Ralph Nader. You know, we're getting some real fucking education dropped in here.
Screw you, Nader. You can't tell me how to live my life.
Fuck you, Ralph Nader. That's why you lost the presidential bid, you asshole.
Like 7 times. You were too cautious. I'm sure he was, you were too cautious.
I'm sure he was fine. I don't know anything about his politics.
Me either.
Except he wanted people to wear seatbelts.
How dare he? That alarm is fuck.
But in the back, we have Jim or Jimmy or Jimbo, depending on who's talking to him, who's played by Crispin Glover.
The Crispin Glover.
And then Teddy.
Yes, Teddy. It shouldn't have been so hard for me to remember Teddy. Like, his pickup line is, do you want to kiss the teddy bear?
Do you want to?
He says it like 4 teddy times.
Do you want to give teddy bear a kiss? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember the actor's name, but he's from The Last American Virgin.
Oh, okay.
Did you ever see that?
I don't think so.
So it's like Cannon's, quote, teen sex comedy from the 80s. And so, like, you think, oh, man, Cannon Film Group, teen sex comedy. This has got to be gold, right? It's the most depressing fucking movie. Oh my God. It's like the usual kind of thing of like teen boys trying to get laid or whatever, but like it's real goddamn depressing. Holy shit. It's a gut punch of a movie. It is no John Hughes, you know, misogynist laugh riot kind of a thing, you know.
Interesting.
It's a downer. It's a brutally honest, like, solid film, but goddamn, it is not a good time for a, quote, teen sex comedy. But it's like a one-to-one remake. No, you gotta see it. You should see it. It's like a one-to-one remake of, because Golan and Globus were Israeli? Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
So it's like a direct remake of an Israeli coming-of-age film. Only in America and super fucking depressing.
Huh.
And Teddy there is the star. Unless I'm totally mistaken, which I could be 1.5 beers into the evening.
We'll take your word for it. But
and if I'm wrong, tell me on Twitter, because I don't check Twitter. So
tell us in the form of a 5-star iTunes review.
Those are the only complaints we will respond to.
Just if they're 5-star iTunes reviews.
Direct cash donations.
Oh yeah, you can join Patreon as well, and you can complain about anything you want if you're paying us.
Oh my god.
But Jimbo is broken up with his girlfriend BJ Betty.
BJ Betty, she's called.
Yeah,
that's. I wrote that down too. I was like, I don't know. There's a story there that we don't know, which I think is the first sign of how much history they're building up for these characters. You know, when she's called BJ Betty, it's like, what's going on there? There's a history there. And then Jimbo is talking about how he was calling her and she would take his calls, but then she wouldn't take his calls. And clearly there's like a lot of backstory for this character.
Yeah, there's,
you know, we don't get much more, but like it's just enough that if you've been through something like that, you can empathize.
Absolutely.
It's just enough to empathize.
It's vague. It's ambiguous enough that you can imprint your own relationship you've definitely had with BJ Betty.
Exactly. You know, the same thing with like Sarah. And this is why the final chapter is, to my mind, an objectively good film. Is, you know, when you're looking at a film like this, and especially because it's horror, right? When you're looking at a horror film, you can't know who the final girl is up front. You have to hide the final girl in an ensemble. And so, you know, it ends up being Trish, and I think we kind of see it being Trish from the start.
Yeah.
But it honestly could have been pretty much any of them. You know, we don't know really, but we're given enough for each character to kind of understand who they are, or at least the main stories, you know, even if we don't know Doug that much, we know Sarah, you know, and Sarah's sort of this, maybe a virgin? I don't remember if she says that, but she definitely doesn't have, quote, a reputation, right?
No, yeah, I think the implication she's a virgin, but she's clearly, she has not dated much regardless.
Yeah, and she's not the kind of, she's not the kind of gal who's going to go skinny dipping, you know?
Yeah.
Like, everybody else goes skinny dipping. She's not giving into that peer pressure because she's just not that kind of girl, you know? And she doesn't have this reputation. She loves Doug, and she's thinking about sleeping with Doug, you know? And like, she's kind of coming to terms with that. And it's a really sweet story.
Yeah.
Again, just enough to make you empathize, which is what you need. And so if you don't get in with Jimbo's story, which his story is kind of suspect because we don't know what the fuck's going on there, except he's being basically bullied by Teddy, you know, throughout the whole movie, then you can connect with Sarah, you know. And if you can't connect with Sarah, maybe you can connect with Sam, who, you know, has her boyfriend, Paul, and Sam has a bit of a reputation, but she's really committed to Paul, who then is like dancing with this other broad, you know, like, who's this girl coming out of the woodwork that Polly's dancing with, you know, and she gets super mad. And maybe you connect with that. It's just enough to give everybody some kind of access to the characters to make you give a shit.
Yeah, it's a good call because there's a nice variety of characters and they all have their unique traits that make them stand out. So you, not only can you connect with somebody or multiple characters, but you actually care when they die. It's like you kind of forget you're in a slasher movie, even though silently in the background, people keep getting slashered.
Yeah, and that's, to my mind, all the best slashers work exactly that way, you know, that you do give a shit. Or they're over the top and complete trash. And I love a complete trash over the top slasher.
Yeah.
But another great slasher that did this earlier that gets credit in the horror community, but I'm reluctant to give it any credit at all because of who made it. But the first film, I don't know that it was the first. I think I saw the final chapter first. But the second film I saw that did this really well is a movie called The Burning. You ever seen this?
No.
It's got Fisher Stevens in it. It's got Jason Alexander. Holly Hunter is in it. It's got this amazing cast, a huge cast of teenagers. And you care about so many of them. You know, they're really realistic people. And when they start to get slaughtered en masse, it's really upsetting, you know, as a slasher film should be. It shouldn't be fun. It should be upsetting because mass murder is upsetting. The problem with The Burning, though, is that it was like the first movie from the Weinsteins.
Oh, okay.
So, like, from a modern perspective, it's a bit hard to sort of, like, get really behind that. You know, it's like, have you guys seen this movie that Harvey Weinstein wrote or whatever? That's I feel a bit rough sort of recommending it, but it does that really well. Maybe better than The Final Chapter, I think, is why I'm bringing it up ultimately, because it does even... I think it does the same thing with the cast of characters there, only there are way more characters in The Burning. Like, there's easily 20 campers who you're expected to give a shit about.
I'll have to check it out.
You should. You should. It's worth a watch. Yeah. I mean, you just have to get past the fact that it is, like, the pet project written by, produced by the Weinsteins. Like, their first thing.
Yeah, that is always problematic, but their name has to be on, like, hundreds of things.
Yeah, I mean, at least on something where it's, like, Good Will Hunting, you can go, well, that's Matt Damon and Ben Affleck's movie, yeah. So, yeah, you know. Like, they had to be there and be a part of it, but no, this, The Burning is, like, their movie.
That is a shame.
It is, because I like it a lot. I think it's a really solid picture, as far as slashers go. But back to The Final Chapter, where we learn that Jimbo is a dead fuck.
Thanks to Teddy's computer, quote-unquote computer.
Imaginary computer.
It's like, let me type all this information into the computer here. I love that scene. It's like, and Crispin Glover is like actually intrigued by what the imaginary computer is going to say about him.
What does it say? And he goes, you don't want to know. It says you're a dead fuck. A dead fuck? There's this pin that I saw, or it's a patch or something that has that on it.
Oh.
Like, you're a dead fuck, you know? And I really want it, but I don't know what I'd do with it, because I'm a father, and I teach at a Catholic university. So
there's no wrong answers with a you're a dead fuck pin. You can do literally anything with that, and it's appropriate.
I feel like wearing it to class is wrong, but that's where I wear most of my pins, is, like, on my, you know, cardigans. I mean, my backpack, my new backpack, I'm putting patches all over it. And, like, the centerpiece is my reanimator patch, which has, like, a severed cat head.
Oh.
And it says, cat dead, details later.
My cat's a dead fuck.
Cat's a dead fuck. And Teddy keeps, like, and this is what I was talking about earlier. Like, even if, you know, the whole Jimbo thing, you're like, dude, she just didn't want to talk to you. You're a pain in the ass. Like, get over it. Even if you think he's, like, this really needy, clingy guy, which he is, you also feel bad for him because Teddy is so hard on him about it.
Yeah.
You know, Teddy's like, you're a dead fuck. Oh, yeah, come along, dead fuck. Grab your bag, dead fuck. Let's go swimming, you dead fuck. Like, the whole movie, everything he says to him, you know, he'll kind of like, dead fuck. You know, like,
which he only does because he knows how much it bothers old Jimbo.
Yeah.
That's how bullies work, is like, when they find something that they know bothers you and they keep at it.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, ultimately, the great thing about Jimbo's story is that being bullied by Teddy inspires him to, quote, steal Teddy's girl.
Yeah.
Right? Teddy's got his sights set on
Terry, Tina.
The, quote, hot one of the two identical twins.
Which is Jimbo's line. Jimbo's like, you know she's the hotter one.
He's like, what are you complaining about? You've got the hot one of the two. They look identical.
They are absolutely identical.
Like, I mean, I know that, like, and when I look at them, I can see that there's a difference. Like, there's clearly a difference. Mm-hmm. But they don't know them. Like, you know, they don't know them at all. And they're dressed identically, you know. So if they've been drinking at all, they probably can't really tell the difference.
I wonder if it's just that Tina's the more forward of the two, so Tina
yeah.
is sexier because she has that confidence and, like, will pursue what she wants.
Yeah, and I mean, there again too, you've got characters who you may be able to, you know, empathize with, especially because if it's Terry, I don't remember which one's Tina and which one's Terry, but if Terry's the one who wants to go home and Tina's like, no, I'm gonna go have sex with this dude.
Yep, you got it right.
You know, maybe you've been the Terry, just like people watching Stranger Things completely, you know, identified with Barb.
Yeah.
You know, Barb was in like three episodes, but like, I get Barb. I'm like, I can't tell you how many parties I've been to where I'm like, I don't want to drink. This is stupid. I get that. I identified with that wholeheartedly, mm-hmm. you know? So maybe Tina is, or Terry, fuck, I lost it already. Terry, maybe you identify with Terry. You know, maybe you're like, yeah, no, man, I've been there. I've wanted to leave, but the people I'm with won't leave because they're like off screwing and I'm sober and I just want to go home.
And maybe you're a Tina. Just want that dick.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's maybe, okay, too.
You know, you get one look at Crispin Glover.
He's dreamy in this. He's so dreamy.
And he can dance, he can boy.
He can fucking dance. He'll dance your pants off.
Oh, Crispin Glover is such an amazing human being.
Yes.
He is so unique. And if you've ever seen like interviews with him, or I mean, if you've watched any of his movies and you know who we're talking about, then you think like he's probably kind of a weird guy. He is.
Yeah.
He 100% is every bit as weird and probably more. I mean, I've seen him do his live show.
Oh, that's got to be fascinating. Yeah.
Oh, my God, Joe. Oh, it's so good. Because, of course, he's made two movies that you can only watch if he shows up at the theater and shows it.
That's
so he's
nuts.
Got two movies.
Yeah.
One's called, oh, God, I can't remember what they're called. God, I can't. And I have no way to check. But the two movies he made, one is the entire cast is people with autism.
Oh, okay.
And the film is full of like crazy imagery of like slugs getting salt poured on them and shit. It's fucking bananas. And then he made another one, I think that's called Everything is Fine or something like that, that was written by a guy. God, I can't remember what he has. But a debilitating condition where he's like confined to a wheelchair, can't really use his limbs. But it's a film that this guy wrote that's basically his sex perversions like on the page.
Oh, wow.
And so he like has sex with all these women and then murders them. And he has these really graphic sex scenes in the movie. And so Crispin Glover made these two movies. And you can only see him if you go to his show. And his show opens with him doing his slideshow. And the Crispin Glover slideshow is easily one of the best shows I've ever seen. And I've seen it twice. And it's spectacular. And it's like he took these old books. And you can buy the books. But he took these really old, old books. And he basically vandalized them and then printed them as his own books.
Okay.
So, like, he, like, fucked them all up and, like, cut chunks of them out and stuff and, like, re-released them as his books. You know, it's like an art piece. But he does them as a slideshow, like, reading them in that Crispin Glover way. And it's amazing.
Wow.
And I got my picture taken with him years and years back. The first time that I saw him, got my picture taken with him. It was like 3 a.m. in the morning. It was like such a long show. It was like a 5-hour show with like his slideshow and the movie and his Q&A. And he carries a copy of, the book Propaganda. He carries a pocket-sized copy of that in his pocket. And he'll like break it out during the Q&A and start ranting about it. He's amazing.
I'm a huge fan.
What a human.
He's a weird guy, but I'm a huge fan of his.
He's also responsible for changing some ways that the film industry works.
Yep.
Because Zemeckis and them used his likeness in
Back to the Future
Part 2 without paying him anything. They used his likeness. And so, you know, he sued the shit out of them.
And changed film forever.
Yep. God, I love him. And he's so wild in this movie. To have him in the final chapter really elevates it to a level that without him, I don't think the movie would even come close to reaching.
And he can dance.
He can fucking dance. That dance is epic.
There's got to be a gif of that I can post.
Oh, yeah. No, I have one on my computer right now.
Okay, great. Like,
I fucking love that dance. I mean, between him and then you got your Corey Feldman, you know. And then the guy from Last American Virgin, I'm assuming, in my, you know, semi-inebriated state. You know, it's quite the cast. And damn, if Crispin Glover does not steal the show at many points.
He does. His death is probably my favorite in the movie.
And it's also super heartbreaking, which is why it works so well.
Yeah, because you really care about that guy now. It's like he's gone through this entire arc of like validating his own existence and getting the girl and, you know, rubbing it in Teddy's face and getting his little revenge on his bully, and then unceremoniously gets a corkscrew shoved through his hand and a butcher, like a meat cleaver, to his face.
It's so fucked. And I mean, again, even if you see him at first thinking, you know, here's this guy who just can't take no for an answer. You know, what a piece of shit he is. He keeps calling this girl and he won't leave her alone and he's real needy. It becomes that story about taking down his bully.
Yeah.
You know, but like Teddy becomes a bully to him, and then Teddy gets really like rapey. Like Teddy tries to, I mean, he just like throws himself on top of Tina. You know, it's disgusting.
Yeah, he's a little too aggressive and not picky. Like when one girl falls apart, he's on the next one like a rabid animal. And it's only once everyone's paired off that he gives up and gets high and watches his nudie movie.
Yeah, exactly. He's a sort you know. You know, he's a kind of person that you've met.
Everyone knows a Teddy. You know? Absolutely. You probably know several Teddies.
Yeah. Even if you don't know they're Teddies, you know them.
You're aware. You've met a Teddy, even if you're not aware he's a Teddy.
But I also like that when Jimbo asks Tina if he was any good, if he was a dead fuck.
Dead fuck, yeah.
He's like, was I a dead fuck? And the way Crispin Glover says that is delicious. I mean, he just chews the words dead fuck. Like every time he says it, it's so good.
You can feel the pain of it. You can feel if she has any criticism, it's going to completely break him. I was like, this is the best I could do. This is my best fuck. Is it a dead fuck?
And she says that he was, quote, incredible. I mean, granted, he does jump the gun a bit and say, like, that, you know, this is love or whatever later. And, like, clearly she has no intention of, like, being around him maybe any other evening ever.
He does that,
except
too.
Except maybe during this.
I know Sarah.
I swear he does.
Sarah has a line about how she thinks she's in love with Greg or whatever, and he kind of like dismisses it, like, hey, what'd you say? So that gives her an out to take it back or just go to the room.
I thought he said like love Teddy, love, or something. I could be mistaken.
I don't remember.
And I could
part.
Just be mixing it up with Sarah. That's true. But one thing I was thinking about while watching that scene where she's like, you were incredible or whatever, and how vindicated he feels. You remember the scene in Revenge of the Nerds?
I've never seen Revenge of the Nerds.
You've never seen Revenge of the Nerds?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay, so there's a scene in Revenge of the Nerds that's very problematic.
I've heard of it. I think I know
actually
exactly
know the writer.
Scene you are talking about.
The writer teaches at DePaul, Steve.
Oh, cool.
He's a colleague of mine. But there's this scene in Revenge of the Nerds where Robert Carradine, his character basically tricks the quote hot chick, like the cheerleader chick, into having sex with him, and she thinks that he's like the jock, like her jock boyfriend,
yeah,
who's the Marcy Darcy's husband from Married with Children, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, yeah, I know who you mean.
Okay, so like that's her boyfriend, but he tricks her into sleeping with him, Robert Carradine's character. And she's like, wow, you were fucking amazing or whatever. And she's like, how, like, I've never had sex that good. Like, how come you were that good? And he says, well, you know, or she's like, how come you're so much better than Bobby or whatever the fuck his name is, right? And he goes, well, that's because all jocks think about all day is sports and all nerds think about all day is sex. And I thought about that in this scene with Jimbo, that when she's like, you were incredible. You know, and he's like, oh my God, I feel so good about it. I'm like, that's because you're a fucking nerd, bro.
Yeah.
Like, that's all you think about is like how to please your lady. You know, and even though he's a needy, clingy, probably calls too often, should take no for an answer kind of dude, when the person who's going to give him a chance gives him a chance, he's got something for him. And not to say that anybody listening, you should go ahead and sleep with the needy, clingy asshole because they're going to be good in bed. They're still going to be needy and clingy.
Yeah. But, it's hard to break those habits.
But if you like a needy, clingy asshole and you think, you know, maybe he's the one, you're probably going to have some good sex. I think that's what the movie's telling us, message-wise. Revenge of the Nerds told us the same thing.
God bless the 80s.
Thanks, Steve. I'll tell him next time I see him.
So as the climax ramps up and these kids keep dying, I thought it was weird.
Oh yeah, and people get murdered.
Yeah, there's
in this
a bunch
movie.
Of murdering going
that?
On as well. Like, girl in the raft gets murdered. Her boyfriend gets murdered after realizing he can't cheat on her with Tina. You know, Jimbo
Not
and
that
Teddy.
He can't. He won't.
Everyone's getting murdered in the background. Doug in the shower gets murdered. Sarah gets. Oh yeah, she gets murdered trying to escape. Yeah, like everyone gets.
Doug
murdered.
And Sarah. Doug and Sarah brings me way down. Like that's so depressing.
Yeah. Because Sarah's so chaste. And Doug's pretty...
Yeah.
Doug's a good guy, too. Like, he doesn't pressure her at all. He's just, like, hanging out with her and being cool. And she's the one who's like, we should sleep together. And he's like, cool, let's do that.
You also stopped saying something. You started to say something and then stopped yourself. And in doing so, ended up saying something that's really, really accurate. Doug's pretty.
Doug,
he is an absolutely gorgeous man.
Doug is gorgeous because at the beginning of the movie, I thought he looked like a young samurai cop. And, when they're all hanging out in the living room
Hannon.
Dancing, I thought, no, he looks like Rob Lowe, like 80s Rob Lowe, which is like the epitome of gorgeous man.
You know, he's a pretty fella. He's maybe the most beautiful person in the movie.
Yes.
Which...
Which is up. And he's up against some stiff competition. There are some good looking people in this movie.
There are gorgeous folk in this movie. It's like, this has nothing to do with anything. I just said it recently. So this is why it's springing to mind. But when I was watching Clueless with Amber recently, I was like, it's fucking unfair to everyone in this movie that Paul Rudd is the prettiest human being in this film.
Yeah.
You know, and like this guy who plays Doug has that kind of a thing going for him where he's the most beautiful person in the movie. And you're like, I don't know if that's fair to all the ladies.
All these women who are willing to do all of these things and just be pretty and really cool. And Doug just blows them all out of the water.
Yeah.
Where's the dick, though? Where's the dick?
Where's the dick, man? He's also in a movie. I've only seen him in one other thing that I can think of. He's in a movie called Hell Knight.
Okay.
With Linda Blair. So in that movie, he's the second prettiest. By my estimation, that's from 83.
So right before
it's
this.
Also a slasher movie. Yeah. And I don't think I've seen him in anything other than these two, but I've watched these two movies enough that I've seen him a bunch thanks to just those two.
Yeah.
I could look it up, but again, I have no access to the internet from my phone.
I mean, I looked him up because, you know, at first I really thought he might have been the guy who played Samurai Cop. And I was like, and I didn't recognize really anything else that he had been in.
You should see Hell Knight, though. That's good.
Okay.
I like that one. It's a slasher where you're like, at a certain point, you go, this is going to suck. There are only four people here. And then through like a contrived set of circumstances, like three other people show up. And you're like, oh, thank God.
Now we can have a Hell Knight. This is the making of a Hell Knight.
Because it's like four people have to go stay in a supposedly haunted house overnight to be so that the two ladies... God, I can't remember the narrative exactly, but I think the two ladies are trying to get into the sorority. I don't remember. Jesus. But it's like a sorority initiation kind of a thing.
Okay.
And there are two guys there, too. And they just have to stay the night in this place. And it's supposedly haunted. But then, like, three other people show up to kind of terrorize them to play pranks. And you're like, oh, they're fucking going down every one of these assholes. So when they show up, you know the body count's about to rise.
What I was going to say earlier,
off topic though, that is
as this movie builds to its climax. Who's Tommy's sister?
Trisha.
Trisha's getting chased around the grounds by Jason. He's made himself known. We know what's going on. She knows what's going on. And then she runs through the house of all the other campers, and like they're strung up all over the place. Like Crispin Glover is like nailed to the door. Nailed to the door frame outside, and I was like, Jason's like posturing in this movie. He's like decorating with his work. It's a unique take on Jason, who's normally just a force of nature.
Yeah, no, he's just having fun with the dead bodies. He's like, well, I don't know. I left this guy in the shower with his face down in the broken glass, but I think it'd be cooler if I like used a railroad spike and like stuck him to the wall. That'd be fucking cool, wouldn't it? I should have done that. That's what I should have done.
You know what? No one living has seen the body. Let's go restage it a little.
Exactly.
I'll just feel much better about it tomorrow if I really give it my best shot.
It's a funny idea that he's like standing around waiting for people's reactions. And like Sarah walks into the bathroom, she sees Doug with his face down in the glass and she screams, and he's like, that's not exactly what I was going for, though.
It's not intense enough. I should kill that whore and then then do Doug again.
Yeah. And he just leaves her dead on the like doorstep or whatever. And then he's like, I'm going to get Doug right.
Really want to nail this one. Pun intended.
Literally.
But the Crispin Glover one is upsetting because he's like crucified to the door frame.
Oh yeah.
And then he like, and then Jason has to go out that door, so he like rips him off of his nails.
There's also this this shirt for the final chapter that I don't remember what company released it. Maybe Gutter Garbs. It's Crispin Glover with the like hatchet in his face, like three times, like repeated across the shirt. And I was like, that's cool, but I can't wear that. That's too sad.
Is this where Jason gets the machete? Does he have a machete in the previous two films at all?
I feel like he would have in the third one. The third one really established like Jason's shit, but
it gave him the mask. When Pretty Boy Mechanic shows up with a machete, I was like, oh wait, this can't be where he gets the machete, right? It's like, it's the fourth movie he starts to machete people?
Could be.
And,
I don't remember.
And he doesn't even really machete people in this movie. He gets macheted.
No. Yeah, he gets that to the middle of his hand.
Oh, yeah. That's messed right? up. And that's, then the middle of his so face. Good.
No, I don't know. I don't remember if he gets that in the third one. I mean, I remember a bunch of stuff about the third, but not that.
Well, he like severs that guy who's walking on his hands in the third one with a machete. That's got to be a machete.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's what I was thinking, is that had to have been a machete, but otherwise he does use like a spear gun and he uses like an axe.
He does favor the axe. He favors the axe a lot in this one. He likes the old axe and spears. He likes spears.
I mean, you got to diversify. Yeah. You know, if you use just one killing implement, then, you know, the kills are going to get boring. It's why a movie like Nail Gun Massacre or something can only be interesting for about 15 minutes.
That is true. But, you know, once he's a zombie, then he's kind of one mind about the machete. He likes the machete from then on.
But he's also, at that point, not averse to using his supernatural strength to bend a motherfucker in half.
That's true, yeah.
The sheriff in that sixth movie who gets bent in half backwards.
That is an upsetting kill, yeah.
Fuck.
Because we were talking about in the episode, it's like, that's not a killing blow. I mean, he'll die eventually, but he didn't die immediately.
No.
Like, he sat there bent in half until he slowly died. Messed up.
So a couple other things
at
the end of the movie that are amazing. Well, one, okay, so we've talked about Manly Man with the machete, who used the car, like, the who jump-started their car or whatever with a knife.
Manly Machismo, yep.
I had to look up who his sister was, because he's like, my sister Sandra, she was a good girl or something. And I was like, who the fuck is Sandra? Who is that? And I think I look it up every time I watch the movie, including the last time I watched the movie, when I watched the first four over the course of 2 days. And I still was like, who's Sandra? Who the fuck is Sandra?
So who's Sandra?
She's the one in the second one who shows up to the like camp counselor training thing with her boyfriend. And I think they're the ones who get the spear through them while they're having sex.
Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure. I'm like...
Oh, they show that.
I mean, I'm like
100%
sure.
They show that.
She shows up with... Yeah.
She's
I'm like
100%
sure she shows up with her boyfriend, but then I'm 50% sure that's her who gets speared.
Okay.
But only because I looked it up midway through the movie. I was like, who the fuck is Sandra? He's like talking about Sandra like I should know who that is. I was like, is that one of the final girls from the other movies? And it was like, no, it was just random woman from the second movie. And think about that, too. Who watching this movie... when it came out, would have remembered who Sandra was.
Maybe you don't really need to. Just like, she's one of the girls that Jason killed. Good enough.
But at that point, it's like, why? I know why you would bother, but it's like, why such a, like, a bizarre, like, random character? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. But fuck that, because then a couple amazing things happen. One, the dog jumps out a goddamn window to get away from Jason.
That is weird.
That's the best thing that happens, like, in that latter, like that last half hour of the movie, when Jason's like going after the dog and it goes, fuck this, and jumps out the window. Every time I'm watching a horror movie and somebody's in mortal danger and they don't jump out a window, I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? Oh, you jump out that goddamn window.
Trish has a great jump out of a window.
Yeah. I mean, she could have just jumped out the same window as the dog, though. Let's face it. She could have done that.
Is she in the same building?
I don't know. I don't remember where she is.
I think she's in a different room remember where the of a dog... different building.
You think anybody would notice? I mean, I guess if they're really like, let's reference Sandra. Because the audience is really going to care that this is Sandra's brother. I guess they might be that dedicated to continuity.
I mean, I think the reboot did it right. It's like we have our initial slaughter couples. We have our initial group of slaughteries. And then the brother is related to one of them that we've already met in that movie.
And we talked all about that last year.
We did. A year and a quarter ago.
A movie that I detested the first time I saw it. And the second time I saw it, I was like, wow, what was my deal?
Yeah, super fun. So then we have the whole thing where Tommy pretends to be Jason.
And... Oh, wait. Let's step back. Step back first. I wanted to point one thing out about Mr. Machismo.
Oh, yeah.
When he dies... He says, like, six times while Jason's killing him, he's killing me. He's killing me. He's killing me. Get out of here. He's killing me.
Just improvise something there, Jack. Okay.
I mean, people mock, like, the Shakespearean dialogue of that sort, you know? And to hear it in a movie, like, in such a, like, dire situation as somebody being murdered by, you know, a serial killer... I see why it gets mocked, because that's ludicrous to say he's killing me over and over and over again.
It is. It's one of those things that's hard to imagine maybe until you're being killed by a slasher, what you would say. And maybe he's killing me is just feels right in the moment.
I feel like I would diversify it and try to like explain what being killed feels like.
This is not pleasant. He's killing me. It's not as...
You know that...
It's not as good as you would imagine it to be. I mean, it's okay.
You
know that
feeling when you swallow a drink wrong and it goes down the wrong pipe? It feels kind of like that, but like times a thousand.
It's that and like the worst ice cream headache imaginable. But in my heart. I just pissed my
pants.
My bowels are releasing already.
You think that happens when you die, but I'm still alive. I'm in the process of being killed and I've already shat myself.
This is embarrassing. This feels worse than the death.
Go away. You don't need to see this or smell this.
Tell your brother I really like his masks.
But yeah, then Tommy.
it's a weird moment because Trish like takes Jason on the runaround and jumps out a window and, you know, does all this stuff so that to give Tommy enough time to get away. And then she comes back to their house and Tommy's still there cutting his hair.
She's like, God damn it, Tommy.
I jumped out a fucking window so you could get away.
The dog and me both.
The dog jumped out a window so he could get away, and then I jumped out a window so you could get away.
I watched the love of my life potentially die.
As he narrated.
Just so you could get away. As he narrated his own death.
Tommy's the one who kills Jason with a machete to the face. Except he's still twitching, so then Tommy goes nuts with the machete. The process of doing this is apparently so scarring that maybe Tommy's going to be the next serial killer. He's going to be the next Jason.
Yep, there's the promise of that.
Yep.
Whether or not they follow through, you'll have to find out.
In Jason 5, A New Beginning.
I was going to say in December or whenever the fuck you said the next.
The next Friday the 13th is December. So we'll see where that takes us. Well, we're getting a little long on time. Do you want to talk about the guilty pleasures of characters in Friday the 13th, the final chapter?
Yeah, let's see what we can do.
All right. You give me any character you want, and I will tell you unequivocally, in the canon, without dispute, what their guilty pleasure is.
It's got to be Terry.
Ah, okay. You can do the hitchhiking chick.
I 100% knew you were going
to
say that.
It just occurred to me, so you knew it better than I did.
I knew you were going to say exactly that.
All right. I'm, I guess, more predictable to you than to myself.
All right. So they make a point of like highlighting that the hitchhiker is overweight. Like, there's a whole deal about that when Teddy leans out the window and he's like, you know, hey, you got a sister, whatever. And he, like, makes fun of her for being big. I think the movie would also want us to think that her weight is a major problem. You know, like, in the world of Friday the 13th, there's nobody above a size, like, 2.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they just don't exist in this world unless there's something wrong with them. So I propose she has diabetes, right? And that's why she's going to Canada, because our healthcare system is fucked.
I mean,
and she's going up there.
Like, ugh.
I mean, I couldn't tell you anything about the. You were there, Joe. We weren't that old in 1984. For most of it, we weren't born. So, I'm just proposing she's going to Canada because she's really like set on this hippie thing. Like, clearly her guilty pleasure is like this whole hippie deal, which has been done for like 5 years anyway. But she's just like, fuck America. I'm going to Canada and I'm getting that sweet, sweet health care. So her guilty pleasure is not dying a miserable fucking death thanks to our broken healthcare system in America.
It's a good one.
Which in America, we're led to believe is something we should feel guilty about. Not being willing to die a horrible, miserable death because our system is fucked.
Yeah. If you don't like it, leave it. Okay.
Yeah, but then you talk about doing that and they're like, whoa. It's those people who have the answer, you know, the answer for everything. Oh, well, you get what you pay for. It's like, I don't have anything. So what do you want from me, assholes?
It's like when Trump won the election and I was bitching on Facebook and talking about wanting to leave the country and live anywhere else. And my stepdad was like, well, you must not like capitalism then. I was like, what's capitalism ever done for me?
Yeah. Capitalism is fucked up. It's a system that actually promotes exploitation of other human beings.
Yeah.
That's the end of capitalism. That's where capitalism goes.
In order for you to win, other people have to lose. There's no real in between there.
No, exactly. It's a system that promotes greed.
Yeah.
Like, that's the people who win. And, like, you know, there's the whole, the myth of the bad actors. You know, it's like a few greedy capitalists ruining it for everybody. Fuck you. Yeah. Fuck off.
That is not true. I listened to a podcast the other day and was talking about how being extremely wealthy has the same kind of effect on your mind as like blunt force trauma. It kind of causes your brain to rot at a basic level. That's why so many like uber rich people are kind of also evil.
Fuck them. I'm going to make the bold claim right now of saying, fuck you, you rich people.
Eat the proletariat.
All 10 of you 1%ers, come at me.
Yeah. Let's see how much power.
Although they
you
could
really
pay
have.
Other people to come
yeah,
at
they
me.
Yeah, they could pay. They're going to pay for that.
And what do they care what I say?
Terry's guilty pleasure is assuming the identity of Tina.
Oh, obviously.
Obviously, yeah. It's right there. I feel like she just has to slightly change her personality and people mistake her for Tina. It's like, then she's the sexy one just because she's a little bit more confident and she's pretending to be confident. And I think she enjoys that being Tina when Tina's not around.
Except I wouldn't think that she would do it in like a way where then like she would sleep with people. I think she would do it to like get discounts on like,
oh yeah, she sees people
on, like,
doing
food at the
Tina.
Local restaurants or whatever.
So if she's Tina, then she gets to take advantage of. It's like a con. And I was like, if you're stupid enough to give me things just because I'm a little bit more confident, you think I'm my sister, then you know, more power to her.
Yeah, like Tina always flirts with the guy down at like the, you know, because it's like a small like country town or whatever, you know. Yeah. So like, you know, Tina always flirts with the guy, you know, at the whatever the gas station where they have the fried food or whatever. So he always throws in like a free helping of like tater babies because she flirts or whatever. Mm-hmm. So Terry likes those free tater babies.
Terry loves a tater baby.
She loves them. So, you know, she uses that not to get the boys, but to like get all the other perks.
Yeah, exactly. I think she's not really into being sexually promiscuous, but she likes the perks of being Tina.
I like it. And also, we gave a good solid jab at the fucking broken ass system.
That's right. Any excuse to.
And I mean, here's the thing, Joe. We're almost 35. Like, what are they going to do to us? You know what I mean? We're at a point in our lives where we haven't achieved so much that they could take things away from us.
They're gonna just wait for us to die of an illness we can't afford to treat.
I mean, that's my thought exactly.
That's their ultimate revenge.
I mean, the idea is that, you know, eventually all of us with student debt will just fucking kill ourselves and then they'll, I don't know, use our bodies to live forever.
Darkest Timeline. Anything you want to plug or recommend?
Oh my god. Okay, so the weekend this goes up, if I'm not mistaken, we are doing an episode on Cadaver Cast of Who the Al Is Ghostface.
Oh, okay.
So, though it's not Friday the 13th related, it is slasher related. Mm-hmm. So, you should check that out. I'll plug that.
That's over at Cadaver Cast.
Cadaver Cast, the show hosted by my 7-year-old son, who's of course never seen the Scream movies, but I showed him one of the TV spots and about 10 seconds of another one and then a picture of Ghostface and let him just guess what Scream is about. And so he tells his own version of what the story of Scream would be. And it's a lot of fun, and he gets a couple minor things right. And then one huge thing right that is shocking to me that he got right.
All right.
With no ability to know such a thing. So
I look forward to it. Definitely I like the Who the Owl Is specials.
Yeah, we've got a couple more lined up for this year. And we're working on a big monster stampede that we're going to record tomorrow that we're really excited about. And then October is just going to be batshit because we're putting out 4 episodes publicly, and then we've got Al and I have 3 that are going up on Patreon, and then I have another one on Patreon.
And, you know, we have something planned for Patreon, a Patreon exclusive quote unquote guilty we have to get to. That'll be a September sometime release if we record it. So,
with me?
Yeah.
Was I part of this? With you. You'll have to remind me.
I will. So, yeah, you can join our Patreon page, patreon.com/wordsalad, which supports Cadaver Cast and Word Salad Radio and gets you access to all the exclusives and early access to a lot of Word Salad Radio shows.
And I'm hoping that I can find time to post a bunch of our stuff early moving through October because we're getting a nice backlog there. So if I can get them edited, we should have them up early as well for Cadaver Cast.
Nice. So a lot of early and exclusive stuff coming up the next couple of months. I would like to recommend a movie called Love Crime.
Love Crime.
I think that's right. Love Crime. It's a French film with Kristen Scott Thomas. And it's like a Hitchcockian level thriller. It's so fucking good. So I would recommend that. I watched it on Mubi, but by the time this comes out, it will be off of Mubi.
I got to get caught up on my Mubi stuff.
Such is the nature of Mubi. But that's one of the better movies I've seen on there in a while.
I also have no way to watch it with no internet on that half of my apartment.
Oh, yeah, so. That's a good call. Because, I think it has 4 days left as of us recording this.
Not good.
But I highly recommend it. You can follow us on Twitter at Word Salad Radio. You can join our Facebook group, the Word Salad Radio Heads. Go and leave us a 5-star iTunes review. Like I said, I've been getting a few, and it's really flattering. It's really great. Feel like maybe things are taken off in a way that they haven't in the past. It's great. I love it.
It's all those sick jabs at capitalism.
that's what
come
really
on, millennials and Gen Z. Let's
get all the millennials rock take hard. It down. Where's the dick, millennials? Where's the dick?
Where's the dick? It's in Canada. Canada and love.
And with that, we will say good night. Thank you for listening. You are not guilty.